woke up this morning early, despairing of the amount of time that we have in the morning here, because this chapter is so rich. I'm not going to touch on everything, obviously, and if I miss something, please be gentle with me. This is obviously the beginning of the threshold of the Bible and the message of life. And it's interesting how God begins that lesson in chapter 1. So we're not going to read Genesis 1 quite yet. I'm going to leave that for a little later in this message. But verse 1 we read last week, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that's seven words in the original Hebrew. But the idea is that he created the heavens and the earth is called a merism. It's like us saying from the north to the south, or the young and the old. It's taking the two and saying he created everything. He created the heavens, he created the earth, he created everything. There is nothing that has been created which hasn't been created by God. And we see that echoed in John chapter 1, verse 1, when it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. Nothing was made without him. All things that were made by him. So God made everything. And you'll see a little outline there in your bulletin of this morning. And just a slight roadmap to let you know where I'm going is that I would like to deal with some of the setting and the purpose of Genesis 1 once again, because there's a lot of confusion over that. Dealing with something called genre, which basically will guide us in how to read Genesis 1. There's a hopeless confusion on that, where everybody seems to get their axe and want to grind it on Genesis 1. Let's listen to what the text has to say about itself. And then we'll deal with some of the structure of Genesis 1, leaving a lot of the details to be filled in the care groups in your personal study, one with another. Well, in your group studies, one with another. And then ending up with, hopefully, what does it mean? And I want to end at 11 so we can sing that grand hymn, How Great Thou Art. So keep me to that. When I'm asked that age-old question, which came first, the chicken or the egg, I have absolutely no difficulty answering that question. Genesis 1:21 says that God created all the winged birds after their kind. The chicken came first. So let's lay to rest the age-old question. But there's a lot more in Genesis 1. This is a very profound chapter with transforming, life-transforming truths in it. And so with the setting and purpose, let us remember again from last week that this is the first part of the book of Moses. The book of Moses being composed of the first five books of our Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So Moses is writing to Hebrews who have been living for hundreds of years in Egypt, and the latter part as slave labor. And during those hundreds of years, we know that they took up the worship of the Egyptian gods. Joshua chapter 24, when Joshua is writing and referring to what the Hebrews were doing in Egypt, says, throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped in Egypt and serve Yahweh, serve the Lord. So we see that they were worshipping the gods of Egypt. And from this worship, we see that they adopted the Egyptian worldview. They adopted the Egyptian view of the world, the system by which they would make decisions, the decisions which governed how they thought. And we see that from that worship to worldview, it governed their ways, it governed how their mind operated. It governed how they lived their lives. So we've got three W's there. Worship leads to worldview. Worldview drives our way, how we live. And we see this perhaps in a different context, of course, in Psalm 106, verses 35 to 39, where the psalmist writes about this same principle. In verse 35, we see worldview. They, the people of God, mingled with the nations. They exchanged pledges with the nations and adopted their customs. In verse 36, we see worship and service linked together. In fact, the word for serve in Hebrew, avad, is also translated worship. So you can see how closely linked the concept of what we worship is with what we serve. It's the same word, avad. They served their idols, which became a snare to them. And we see their ways, the way they thought, the way they acted. In verse 37, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters to demons. They shed innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan. And the land was desecrated by their blood. They defiled themselves by what they did. By their deeds, they prostituted themselves. So again, we see this principle emerging, and if we could have that schema of the service, what we serve is what we worship. So we see, again, worship, and as humans, we serve what we worship. It's invariable. Even people who do not believe there's a God serve that God of no God, atheism. So we serve what we worship, and that leads to a worldview, the way we view the world. And that leads to the governing, the driving of our mind and actions in the way we live. And we see this, don't we, in the verses that Eric quoted in his baptism last week. This concept in Romans 12, verse 1, I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice to God. In other words, he's calling us to worship him with everything that we are. And that leads to, in verse 2, the renewing, being transformed by the renewing of our mind. Taking on a, if I can use the word Christian or God view of the world. And then we see in the rest of the chapter that that will drive how we live. Worship to worldview to ways. Now, God, in calling these Hebrews to himself, said to them in Leviticus 19, he says to Moses, he says, speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. So he's calling them to have a life that is holy, just like Yahweh is holy. So if we work back, how is that going to be accomplished? The holiness must come from a changed worldview. And that changed worldview is completely dependent on a changed view of who God is. You can't change people from the outside. And so you can see it is very important what you believe, because what you believe is how you live. But what you believe flows from the revelation of God, or what you make up in your own minds as God. So corrupt living comes from a corrupt view of God. Holy living must be based on a pure view of who God is. So in order to bring about a holy people, God must start from scratch with God 101 in Genesis 1:1 and teach us truly who God is so that we can worship the one true God. And from that we can see that drives how we view the world. And that in turn will cause us to live holy as Yahweh is holy. You see that link? Worship, worldview, ways. Now let's look at genre for a moment, because there are so many ways in which people view Genesis 1. Most people, and a lot of what we call liberal theologians, would view Genesis 1 to 11 as Hebrew myth. And by what they mean by that is it's simply something that has been written to satisfy questions of a primitive, unscientific, and therefore ignorant people. And therefore, this is just a story concocted to satisfy the curiosity of an ignorant people and isn't true. Well, that's one way of looking at it, but it's the wrong way of looking at it, in my not-so-humble opinion. people say Adam wasn't real. Eve wasn't real. Seth wasn't real. Noah wasn't real. They're just fictional characters to try to explain how things came to be. It's in Hebrew myth. But, I mean, Jesus doesn't treat it that way. You look at his genealogy. It contains David, who was a very real king of Israel. And as we go through the very same genealogy, we come across Seth and Adam, who had to be very real human beings. So the New Testament view of these people is they weren't fictional characters. They were very real historical characters. So if we're going to give the Bible any credence, if we're going to listen to what it says about itself, we have to start with the view that this is a historical account of some sort. We see in the 1900s and in the 1800s something called evolution, Darwinism, emerge. And it seems that in the 1800s and 1900s, Christians didn't quite know what to do with evolution. So some of their theologians sort of tried to view how they could fit evolution into the text of the Bible and created a theory called the Reconstruction Theory or the Gap Theory. An undefined length of period between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2 where you could fit all this evolutionary stuff in there. So they conveniently said, well, we can fit it in here, but it really doesn't have anything to do with the story of the Bible. But really, that's not a biblical approach either. Because if we're to give any credence to the Scripture, Genesis 5 tells us, that death came from sin. And there was no sin and there was no death prior to Genesis 3. So there's none of this stuff that could have happened before Genesis 3. And that includes, by the way, Genesis 1. And then in our late 20th century, we see scientists begin to see that evolution really is a fraud. Good science is enough to refute evolution. Evolution is not a theory. A theory has to be measurable, repeatable, and provable in some way, observable. And evolution is none of those things. Now, when I talk about evolution, I'm talking about cross-special evolution, where crocodiles become birds and apes become humans and that kind of nonsense. We've seen the speakers that have been here from time to time from Institute of Creation Research who have indicated to us very clearly that the transition between fossils of one species and fossils of another species are just totally absent from the fossil record. So any model or philosophy that tries to create some kind of a transitional species between a crocodile and a bird or between an ape and a man is complete fiction. It's not based on any fact at all. It's a philosophy. It's a desperate way of believing that so many people accept uncritically. I've listened to Dr. Dwayne Gish of Institute of Creation Research. Our kids have gone and listened to this. And good science is enough to refute evolution. But Genesis 1 was never written as a 20th century apologetic against evolution. It is not a scientific explanation of creation. I'm not denying that it's consistent with good science, but I'm saying it's not written with that purpose. A tree. My picture of the tree. Let me ask you what that is. Any takers? It's a tree. Okay, you can see even it's a red oak. We can go that far. It's a red oak. Is it really a tree? Is it really a tree? No, it's not. It's a picture of a tree. It's a representation of a tree. Because if you look at that, you go up there and feel the trunk, you're not going to see bark there. The leaves, they're just representations of leaves. So you can't smell the tree. You can't climb that tree. It's a lot smaller than normal. It's just one side of the tree, and it's very flat. This is a representation of a tree. It's an accurate representation of a tree. Nobody would deny by looking at that, that that representation of the tree doesn't mean that there are real trees out there. This is an accurate representation of a real tree. But it's given to us as a representation. It only gives us one view of what a tree really is. A tree is a lot more than this representation, but this representation shows us accurately what this tree is in one way. In the same way, Genesis 1 is an accurate representation of creation, but it only gives us one important side of creation. Now, don't be confused by this, because John's gospel does exactly the same thing. In chapter 20, right near the end of that chapter, John gives his reasons for selecting and arranging the limited material he's put together as John's gospel. He hasn't told us everything. He says, these miraculous signs, it says that Jesus did many other miraculous signs, but these miraculous signs are recorded for a particular purpose, that you might know that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing, you might have life through his name. So it's not an exhaustive story about Jesus. It's an accurate representation of Jesus to convince the reader that he is Jesus, the Son of God, the Christ, and that on the basis of that belief, you might have life that is life indeed through his name. And so what we have in Genesis 1, I would suggest to you, is an accurate representation of creation, not for scientific purposes, not for historical purposes even, but for theological purposes. It is written this way to tell us something about God and about us. Now, don't go away saying that John doesn't think this is a historical document. It is an accurate representation of what occurred, but its focus is theological. Its focus is God 101 to Hebrews 1,400 years before Christ. But we have much that we can learn from this. So let's go to the structure, trying to keep with our time here, and look at Genesis 1 itself. I encourage you to bring your Bibles, not to rely on the PowerPoint, because there's a lot of stuff that we'll be talking about in our Bibles that are not necessarily shown on the PowerPoint. If we can learn something about the form, the literary form of Genesis 1, we can see how it was designed, and from that we can get a better idea of what it means, how it functions, what we're being taught here. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And if we go down to chapter 2 and verse 3, we see the end of this particular section. God blessed the seventh day and made it holy. Remember what he's trying to do to these Hebrew people. Be holy as I am holy. He blessed the seventh day and made it holy because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. So we see almost bookends here, where from Genesis 1:1 to Genesis 2, verse 3, it talks about God creating everything. Verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. He created everything. In chapter 2, verse 3, we see that he ended all the work of creating that he had done. All the work of creating had been finished in chapter 2, verse 3. So we see that is a unit, a literary unit. Chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 3. Another thing is that chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, is an introductory summary. It's not as if God created something and then we see a ruined creation and then he starts creating something new again as if he blew it the first time around. That's another thing I have against the gap theory. It just doesn't wash with the character of God. But chapter 1, verse 1 is an introduction. It's a summary of what the whole of chapter 1 is about. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Full stop. That's the summary. That tells us about everything that happens. And then he goes back and he begins to give us more detail on how he went about that. Let's look at some of that detail. Well, first of all, if you've read through chapter 1, as we will do in a few minutes, you will see that there is a formula that is used over and over and over through these various days. And if you could show me the formula, thank you. You'll see normally an announcement. And if we go and we just test this on the second day, which starts in verse 6, and God said, let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water and water. So we see that announcement, and God said. Then we also see a commandment. Let there be an expanse. And if you have the notes for the care group, you will find that there's five of these seven parts to the formula in that. But this is a little more inclusive. A commandment. Then we see that there's a separation. There's something separated from something else. In this case, we see that an expanse or an atmosphere divided between the waters above and the waters below are separated. Then we see, fourthly, a report. So God made the expanse. Then we see a naming. God called the expanse sky. And the concept of naming in the ancient Near East is very important, and we'll come to that probably next week, the idea of naming. Then we see there's an evaluation, and God saw that it was good. Interesting, on the first day, we see, and God said that it was good, but on the second day, which would be Monday on our calendars, we don't have the word, and it was good. And as Bruce Waltke points out, on this basis alone, Orthodox Jews do not get married on a Monday, because it doesn't say, and it was good. But you'll note it says twice, and it was good, for Tuesday, and that's the best day if you're Jewish to get married. Guys, keep that in mind. And then we see there's a chronological framework. There was an evening, and there was a morning the second day, or the third day, or the fourth day, whatever. So you see that there's a formula. This leads us to conclude that this is not a scattered bunch of information thrown together, but a very carefully crafted piece of literature. Very, very well conceived. Put together meticulously with the purpose of teaching us about God and about His holiness. Now, in verse 2, we come to these words. Now, the earth was formless and empty. In the Hebrew, that the earth was tohu and bohu. You've learned some Hebrews today. Okay. Tohu means unformed. It means more than that, but just be very simple here. Tohu means unformed. And bohu means unfilled. Formless and empty. Tohu vabohu, unformed, unfilled. And this gives us the clue as to how this whole chapter is structured. Because days 1, 2, and 3 respond to unformed and show how God formed this creation. Days 4, 5, and 6 respond to bohu and shows how He filled what He formed. Okay, we'll come across that. Okay. So, let's not forget these Egyptian gods either. Do you remember last week how Moses went and intervened as Pharaoh went out in the morning, approaching the Nile River, which to them is the Egyptian god Hapi? It was responsible, this god, to give clear, cool, refreshing water. It was the lifeblood of Egypt. And Yahweh, through Moses, turns their god, Hapi, the River Nile, into blood. The next one is the god of frogs, Heket. And they are hopping all over the place, dying and rotting. Because Yahweh is demonstrating, He's making havoc. He's embarrassing the gods of Egypt. They are worshiping these gods. So what is He showing to the Hebrews? He's showing them that the lifestyle of the Hebrews, which is based on their worldview, is based on their gods. And it's a complete and utter forgery. It's a fraud. We were praying last night about a young lady who is going into Wicca and other things. Paganism is becoming rampant in this country. And it will change the worldview of those who accept those things. And it will change the way that we live. And the society as we know it will cease to be. Because our view of Canada as a nation that is a nation of peace and acceptance is historically based on a Christian view of who God is. But that's wearing out very quickly. And that will change our worldview, and it will change our society radically. So we see that as Yahweh deals with these Egyptian gods, he demonstrates to them that he doesn't even have to roll up his sleeves when he deals with these guys. He embarrasses them. And so we see that as the Hebrews leave, their household of gods is completely wrecked, and their army is destroyed as Yahweh leads his people out to worship him. So don't forget about the gods of Egypt. And so when we come to day one, in verse 3, and God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. So I'll ask you to put up that box, which we have Tohu and Bohu and day one. It's coming up blank. All right. Have you got the whole set? Anyway, a few things to note here is that as you read through here, you might not see it. But for example, there is an Egyptian god of light, and there's an Egyptian god of darkness. The Egyptian god of darkness is Keck. And I did have a picture of Keck in here. I'm really pulling on your strings here. Keck, is he not there? Keck is a guy who looks like Wile E. Coyote on a good day. He's sitting on a throne, and he's got the head. It looks like a coyote. I think he's jackal or something like that. But he's the god of darkness, obscurity, chaos. And Egyptian worldview saw Keck as a creator of certain things, a controller of certain things. But the darkness is something that God deals with. Not Egyptian gods, but Yahweh. And we'll come back to the day four when he fills it. So what we have here in day one is we have formed, something formed, light and darkness. Now let's go to day two. You don't have any of those boxes for Tohu and Bohu that have day one, two, three, four, five, six? Okay, thank you. So day two, and God said, "Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water." That would be water below and water above. So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse or the atmosphere from the water above it. And it was so. God called the expanse sky. And there was evening and there was morning the second day. And of course, there's an Egyptian god of the sky as well. I believe it's either Geb or Shu, one of the two. But again, every day we're going by here, Yahweh has said he did this. And he's blowing out one or two of these Egyptian deities and saying they are nothing. Day three. Verse 9, and God said, "Let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear." And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit, with seed in it, according to their various kinds." And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and the trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. So here we have 3 days that are responding to Tohu, are responding to unformed. And we see that God forms light and darkness. He then forms, very good, sky, or atmosphere, and water. And then we see on the third day, dry land and vegetation. Now, contrary to that there, what we see is we see a movement here from heaven to earth, from God to humans, from up there to atmosphere to dry ground. You see that movement? And God is very interested in dry ground, Eretz, because these people, the Hebrews, under the leadership of Moses, were being taken to a land, Eretz. And we see here that the end result of the forming creative powers of God is dry ground. You'll see this again when we come to Noah after the destruction of the flood. He comes out onto dry ground and a new blessing. And we see that as the Hebrews are led by Moses out of Egypt, the Yam Suf, the Red Sea, opens up and they go across on dry ground. Dry ground is very important to the people of God. A place to possess. A place that is theirs. A place where they can be with God and worship God. Now, let's go to what responds to Bohu. What responds to unfilled. Now he's formed all of these things. Now he's going to fill them. Verse 4, which starts in verse 14. And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky, the astronomic heaven, if you will, to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights. He doesn't even name them, you'll note. He just calls one the greater light to govern the day. We know that as the sun. And the lesser light to govern the night. And two of the more powerful gods of Egypt were Ra, the god Sun. And I had a picture of him too, but they're not there. Okay. And also Khonsu, which is the god of the moon. Both powerful. But as far as Egyptians go, an Egyptian worldview and Egyptian gods are concerned, Yahweh says, nothing. I made the great light of the day. I made the light for the night. He doesn't even name them. And he blows out, again, two of the important deities of Egypt and said, that's not what you worship. You don't worship Ra. You don't worship Khonsu. You don't worship the sun. You don't worship the moon. I made those things on the fourth day. I didn't even start with that. Where were we? Verse 16, God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. Let's keep going. Verse 20, and God said, let the water teem with living creatures and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. He's filling on the fifth day what he formed on the second day. He formed on the second day atmosphere and seas. And so what he's doing is he's filling them now with fish and birds. So God created the great creatures of the sea, and every living and moving thing with which the water teems according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. Verse 24. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds. Now remember, on day three, he formed dry ground and vegetation. Livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Verse 26. And God said, let us make man. Let us make humanity. Let us make Adam in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. And then we have a bit of poetry here, the first bit of poetry in the scriptures. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And we're going to deal with these verses next week, Lord willing. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I will give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning the sixth day. Chapter 2, verse 1. The heavens and the earth were complete in all their vast array. Now, at the beginning, in verse 2, we had it was tohu and bohu. It was unformed and unfilled. And now we see it coming together in chapter 2, verse 1. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed. Thus the heavens and the earth were formed. It answers to days 1, 2, and 3. In all their vast host, in all their vast array, they were filled. And we see tohu and bohu. We go through these days and then we see it drawn together in chapter 2, verse 1. It was all formed. It was all filled. And God ends by saying, the seventh day God had finished the work he had been doing, so on the seventh day he rested from all his work, and God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Now, there's so much there. We've just read it. We haven't dealt with much detail at all. But what does it mean? Let's just deal with a few simple things on what it means as it approaches 11 o'clock and how great thou art. Number one, reading this, you can hardly mistake that God made it all. The merism, he created the heavens and the earth. He created everything. There was nothing that was made that God wasn't involved in making. He made this creation. Nothing else. No tin Egyptian god. Yahweh made this. Secondly, he made it by himself. There were no competitors. There were no co-creators. God made it by himself. In the verses that we've read this morning, 35 times we find the word God. God said. God saw. God separated. God called. God commanded. God blessed. God created. God did it all. Everything that we have is because God has given it to us. Everything. Let me suggest to you what I think is happening here. That God is creating his palace. He calls earth. Now in Hebrew, the word for palace and the word temple are precisely the same word, hekal. So the temple is the palace of the king of heaven and earth. The temple is the palace of God. And as he forms his temple on day 1 and 2 and 3, as he fills it on days 4 and 5 and 6, his temple is almost complete. But as one builds a temple, the very last thing you put in the temple is the image of the deity. Let us create man in our image. We, as human beings, are the image of Yahweh, the God of gods, the Lord of lords, the King of heaven and earth. We are the image of God. And as he calls us to worship him, that will transform our worldview. And that will transform the way that we live so that we can be holy as Yahweh is holy. It's 11:01. Let's go to the Red Hymn Book, number 16. And let's stand and sing this wonderful hymn, this tribute to our God, the King of heaven and earth. Number 16.